Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kimberly St. Julian Barnin. I'm the host of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network Consortium. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Victoria Smulkin, Associate Professor of History at Wesleyan University. We're talking about her new book, A Sacred Space is Never Empty, A History of Soviet Atheism. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly.
Before we jump into the book, I wanted to know a little bit about you. So what's your educational background? What got you interested in religion and atheism in the Soviet Union?
Well, I think my background is maybe a little bit unorthodox for a historian. I actually didn't get serious about history until after I had graduated from undergraduate. So after my BA, so my undergraduate education was this kind of broad liberal arts education and focused on literature and art and writing. So I did photography and writing. And it really was looking at the world. I graduated in 2002. I went to university right near New York. And so my final year of undergrad was it began with 9/11. And in a way that kind of, shook me out of this kind of 1990s mentality in which, as a kid growing up in the 90s, even though I came from the Soviet Union, you still kind of imbibed this atmosphere where the world was just, the Cold War had ended. There was, you were kind of coming of age with the internet and, there was economic growth and you just thought everything was going to get better. And so, you could indulge all sorts of self-searching and, trying to figure out how to be your most authentic self and all this kind of stuff. And, that's really kind of who I was an undergraduate. And I even went to art school for high school. So kind of this kind of wake up call that happened, with 9/11 and the aftermath of that, just kind of turned my thinking to different kinds of questions and just made me realize that, it made me much more interested in the world and in the kind of genealogies of how we got to where we were. And I had a couple years off after undergraduate and I just read a lot. And I realized I'd initially thought I might apply to graduate school for literature, but I realized actually that the questions that interested me were historical questions. And so that's how I ended up doing my PhD in history. And from there, in terms of turning to the specific questions that interested me, religion and atheism, the way that my attention turned to that is when I began to do my graduate work, it was very, the narrative, the overall narrative that we had about the Soviet Union, or the big question, I guess, was about its totalitarian nature. And there the kind of big debates in the field in Russian and Soviet history as they had developed over time, really, you know, to kind of simplify it, went from seeing this as a totalitarian regime to then a kind of turn to social history, in which there was a kind of looking at the social base for Soviet power, and not just looking at ideology and coercion. And then, the kind of coming of age, I guess, of this turn, the cultural turn that was kind of at its height when I entered graduate school. So looking at Soviet subjectivity and the kinds of people that were created through this kind of ideological regime. So, the thing that the kind of narrative or the metaphor that kind of got thrown around was this idea that communism was like a religion or a religion. And I went to UC Berkeley for graduate school. So my advisor was Yuri Slyoskin, and he actually was working on, he at that point was working on The House of Government, which came out last year. Which is a whole book about Bolshevism and the Bolsheviks as a millenarian sect. So, you know, these questions were in the air and during my graduate training. But what I realized fairly quickly was two things. One is that this kind of analogy of communism being a religion was really unexamined in any way that kind of in a more than superficial way, because, for example, it was surprising to me that the Soviets never actually banned religion, right? So there's this kind of assumption that this is an atheist state, which in fact it wasn't an atheist state. It was an atheist party and a secular state, right? So that kind of distinction was surprising, and one that I thought was really important, but that hadn't really been analyzed. And so this idea that, okay, if communism is a religion, but there's still religion, kind of traditional religion, then how does that actually play out? Because then it has a kind of competing, religious narrative at play. And so there was this question of, okay, so how did they actually try to compete and replace traditional religion? So there was literature on this, on some of this for the early Soviet period in the 20s and 30s. And there was some great work on, for example, the League of Militant Godless. But it still didn't answer for me the question of how this would enter into, especially into private life and into family life. So I was interested in rituals in particular, life cycle rites. So who would marry you? Who would baptize your child? If anybody, who would bury you? How would people, transform these customary ways of being? And it was surprising to me that, in fact, most of those things really continued for long after the revolution. And most of those religious practices, to some degree, didn't really go anywhere. And in as much as the Soviet regime tried to replace them, it was very much these kind of propaganda campaigns for, red weddings or red funerals, and they didn't really penetrate deeply into Soviet society. So that was the kind of starting point. And I went to the archives to look much more closely at this question of rituals, of atheist rituals. And when I found the archive of the Institute of Scientific Atheism, which is the kind of the central institution I examine in the book, there I discovered, thousands of pages of transcripts of professional atheists, which is a profession that I believe really is unique to the Soviet project to be a professional atheist. And they would sit around in committees and try to solve these spiritual problems and answer spiritual questions like what is the meaning of life and how do we approach or address death and how do we get people to stop baptizing their children? What do we offer in its place? And I got completely sucked into those transcripts because what was surprising to me was that these were people who were asking these questions sincerely and really grappling with them. So that was fascinating. But also in this completely, you know, to my eye at that point, in an absurd context in these kind of bureaucratic committees. And then the second part that was surprising was this idea that what was the fact that this was happening so late, that really these questions didn't become the central questions in Soviet ideology until the late 1950s and 1960s. And that was the other question that needed answering, is why did it take so long for these questions? You know, if it really was, if communism really was a religion, why did it take so long for it to address these very basic things that religions, you know, traditionally address? So those were my questions when I went in. And that's what made the subject of the book much broader. In a way, I wish that, you know, I wound up writing the book that I wished that somebody else had written so that I could write my book about, you know, rituals and kind of looking at all of these diverse ways in which, you know, they were created and disseminated and how they succeeded and how they failed. I mean, there's a whole story there that only gets, you know, a little bit of attention in the book, but nobody, that was the final thing that I realized, that, you know, atheism, Soviet atheism, is really a project of the Khrushchev era and the Brezhnev era. And there wasn't really a study of that. And so in order to really be able to understand what these rituals are even about, you have to kind of put them in a much bigger context. And so the book became much more about the political stakes of atheism, the ideological kind of narrative and unfolding of atheism. And yeah, that's how I wound up writing the book that I actually wrote.
It's just really funny that you went in trying to look at these specific ideas of rites and rituals and like, well, no one wrote the book, so I have to do that. And I'm glad you did, because it's fascinating. And some of the things you just said, what made Soviet atheism under Lenin and Stalin different from under Khrushchev and Brezhnev? You said that the Soviet project of really promoting atheism as an ideology really starts under Khrushchev. So how is it you dealt with under Lenin and Stalin?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in the book, I make this distinction that the Bolsheviks and the Communist Party, you know, that they look at religion as these kind of three distinct problems. And the first is this political problem, which is really about institutions and individuals being able to mobilize society, in this specific case, against Soviet power. So kind of counter-revolution. And then there's the ideological problem of religion, which is this idea that people are, you know, holding on to prejudices and superstitious beliefs, and they need to be enlightened, and that these prejudices and superstitions are in fact preventing Soviet people from really embracing the potential of the communist project. And then the third side of it is the spiritual side, which is, okay, how there are all of these things that religion does that aren't just about politics and aren't just about ideas and ideologies, but are about community and are about ritual, for example, and are about aesthetic pleasure and emotions. And so how will atheism deal with that? And that becomes the kind of final stage. So, you know, the question you asked is how is atheism different under Lenin and Stalin? And I guess the short answer is that it really, above all, is a political problem. Religion is a political problem, you know, up until in the early Soviet period, up until World War II. It's this question of, you know, how do we hold on to power? How do we make sure that religion, both at home and abroad, isn't mobilized to bring down the Soviet project. And so all, you know, these other aspects like ideology and enlightenment, right, and scientific enlightenment, which is an important part of the ideological campaign, or, you know, spiritual elements like rituals are really secondary and tertiary in the early Soviet period, because the regime is really fighting for survival at that point. So what that means is largely the atheism, the kind of policy, the anti-religious policy, is really anti-clerical, in the way that we traditionally understand that. It's against clergy and church. And atheism is militant atheism, and they call it militant atheism. Because again, it's this kind of war-like atheism, which is deployed in the service of fighting counter-revolution. So it denounces, priests and the church as kind of, handmaiden of the autocratic state, and as, swindlers that take advantage of simple people. So that's a kind of, it's a political rhetoric that's about undermining the social power of religious institutions and persons. I kind of point out in the book that by the end of the 1930s, that political problem is basically solved from the regime's perspective. It doesn't see the church, the Russian Orthodox Church, being the primary one, but really religious institutions as really a serious political threat by the end of the 1930s. They managed to neutralize it through all sorts of, I think quite well-known repressive policies. Terror against the clergy, shutting down or closing churches, creating very restrictive laws for religious practice that basically keeps it primarily in the sphere of liturgy. And so religion becomes something that happens inside the church, and that's it. In as much as they believe that problem to be solved, atheism is no longer necessary. Right, because it's only necessary in as much as it's addressing an actual problem. And so, what you see, the interesting and surprising thing you see, is that with World War II, atheism basically disappears, and it doesn't return until Khrushchev. So, for from the League of Militant Godless is disbanded in 1941. And it doesn't get, the atheist project doesn't get resurrected until, there's a kind of initial attempt to resurrect it in 1954, but really we're looking at 1958 as the kind of start of Khrushchev's anti-religious campaign. And so in a way, what's interesting is, on the other hand, religion is brought back into Soviet life. So Stalin makes this famous concordat with the church during the war, and there are all sorts of reasons for that. The two primary ones that kind of scholars agree on are, on the one hand, kind of bolster patriotism at home, and on the other, to kind of curry favor with the allies abroad, right, who are consistently drawing attention to religious repression in the USSR. So the church actually is, the patriarchate of the Russian Orthodox Church is restored. There are new institutions established to manage church state affairs, the so-called councils on the Russian Orthodox Church, and the Council on Religious Cults, which is dealing with all non-Orthodox confessions. Those are established in 1943 and 1944. And so really what you're looking at after the war is basically no atheism. This is the late Stalin period from, 45 to 53. There's really not much happening in terms of atheism, other than maybe, some lectures about astronomy, right, or something like this. And on the other hand, you're seeing churches being opened and institutions that are there to manage church state affairs, and the Russian Orthodox Church is becoming much more active also in the international arena. So, so you have this very paradoxical situation, right, where it's the supposedly atheist state that where there's not really a lot of atheism happening. And it's not until Stalin dies and Khrushchev enters into the political arena and tries to redefine Soviet communism and kind of reinvigorate the project and return it to what he believes to be its original and authentic Leninist origins through this broader project of de-Stalinization, that that atheism becomes again necessary, but now not as a political phenomenon, but actually as an ideological one. So Khrushchev makes it very clear that whereas in the early Soviet period, religious institutions and believers were enemies, that under, you know, in the post-war period and under Khrushchev, these are no longer, you know, the church is patriotic, believers are Soviet citizens, but they need to be enlightened. They are people who need to be rescued from their backwardness. And that becomes the new campaign. And indeed, atheism itself is rebranded from being a militant atheism to being a scientific atheism. So it becomes scientific and really it relies above all on various enlightenment practices and above all lecturing, basically lecturing at people about why religion is wrong and why science can help you understand the world much better than religious dogma or theology.
It's really interesting. Does the state or do any of the people who are promoting this, you know, atheism as an ideology for life, do they ever see it as kind of a missionary project? Because it seems very missionary in terms of we have to civilize these people,
right?
You know, they're backward. It's very missionary.
I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, they don't, the answer is complicated because on the, you know, it's yes and no. No, in the sense that they never think of themselves as a religion or a church, right? The church is a backward reactionary institution and they are a progressive, radical institution in their mind and revolutionary. And so there's no analogy to be made there. However, they very much see themselves as in direct competition with the church or with religion in general, but with, I'm speaking usually about the Russian Orthodox Church because it's just the dominant confession in the Soviet Union and in the Russian areas of it, especially. So they don't kind of explicitly think about themselves as missionaries, but they are in directly responding to the perceived missionary activity of the church. They very much are doing missionary work. And in fact, the people who, you know, this is the big kind of problem for atheism is, and they talk about this as well, is okay, so if we're doing missionary work, who are the missionaries, right? Like there isn't a kind of atheist church, actually, right? There's the party, but that's not a atheist church. So who is going to be doing this missionary work? Who's going to go out to the people and preach, you know, the truth? And the people they get kind of find themselves almost despite, you know, their intention of being there in this position are party ideology, kind of propaganda cadres, teachers, right, are kind of the mission, playing the role of missionaries. But really, above all, it's this lecturers who work for this Znanya Society or Knowledge Society, which is expanding exponentially under Khrushchev as an institution whose primary function is to enlighten the people. So these lecturers, in a way, are missionaries, though they would never actually see themselves this way, but they behave this way. And moreover, they even complain that unlike priests, they say this explicitly, unlike priests who are taught in seminaries, you know, hermeneutics and how to speak to people and how to, you know, effectively, carry out kind of pastoral practice, they don't get taught any of this. And they're complaining to the party because they're failing at the task of missionary conversion. And they're saying, but how could we succeed when you're dealing with a priest who's actually trained in hermeneutics and we're not trained to do any of that? You know, we just sit there and read lectures from papers. And so it, but yet they never kind of explicitly say, you know, we're, you know, a missionary organization who is, you know, who's doing, you know, trying to spread the word. They just implicitly are.
That's funny. We have to compete with the priests, but we don't have the priest's knowledge.
Well, yeah, and the training, and you know, the most revealing episode of this, and I, you know, talk about this in the book. It's probably my favorite episode that I found in the archive, and I think it shows almost better than anything else the nature of this problem. Is this moment when one of the kind of most fervent atheists, who himself had been a seminarian and then a teacher in a seminary, but then broke with religion and embraced atheism and became the first kind of major public atheist in the Soviet Union, you know, going on a lecture tour and writing newspaper articles about, you know, why religion is darkness. So his name was Yevgraf Duluman. And I actually interviewed him for the book because he was still alive when I was doing my research, and we kind of corresponded. But I found in the archives of the Institute of Atheism a speech he gave in a transcript where he's trying to explain to his atheist colleagues the nature of exactly the problem that you and I have been talking about. And he says, well, look, let me give you an example. I get sent to a village to do atheist work. And, you know, they don't tell the villagers that I'm an atheist and I'm there to do atheist work. I'm just there, you know, kind of hanging out and looking at village life as far as the villagers are concerned. So they put me in this hut with a family that they tell me is religious, and I'm there to convert them, right? To kind of to explain to them why they shouldn't be religious. He says, now, of course, I don't kind of do this right away, right? I kind of get to know them. I stay with them. I you know, earn their trust and develop a kind of relationship with them. So, you know, I'm just observing for a few days. And then, but what I notice, he says, so after a few days, I notice that every day, the father plays cards with his friends under the icon in the corner. And so he says, well, so I go to him when I finally decide to kind of do my atheist work, right? He says, I go to him and I say, don't you know that you shouldn't play cards under the icon in the corner? That's blasphemy. And the guy says, well, the icons are used to it. They don't care. Kind of like blows them off, right? He says, so then I try to reason with him and say, you know, you shouldn't, you know, you baptize your children, but you're just giving money to the priests, you know, who are, you know, well, first of all, it's unhygienic, right? Your children are going to get sick because you're baptizing them in this filthy water. And then also you're giving money to these priests, and these priests are, you know, are parasites, and, you know, you're just giving them, you know, your hard-earned money for nothing. And the guy says, well, you know, I hope the priest, he says, I know, you know, I don't like the priest, and I hope he chokes on the money, but everybody baptizes their kid and I'm going to baptize mine. And so then Duluman is kind of, you know, checkmated into this. And he says, well, were you baptized? The religious guy asks the atheist, you know, who's preaching to him. He says, were you baptized? And Duluman, of course, like most people, you know, in that generation was baptized. So he says, yeah. And he goes, see, you were baptized. I was baptized. All of Mother Russia was baptized. Look how fine it all turned out. And he says, so he's kind of relaying this as like, how am I supposed to talk to these guys, right? How am I supposed to convince them when they're just like unreasonable? They don't respond to reason. All the kind of logical arguments I throw at them, they just don't care. So in a way, you know, I remember at one point telling the story to a colleague of mine, And we kind of were laughing because in a way it's like, how is his effort to discipline this peasant playing cards under an icon any different than a priest, right? Like a priest would come in and say, don't play cards under the icon, right? And so in a way, you know, like in order for him to convert this guy to being a good atheist, he first would have to make him a good Christian, right? Like he would have to first show the guy that this is wrong, right? And kind of discipline him to understand why this behavior is against, you know, against his religion, to then say, but actually your religion is wrong. So actually, you know, so there's a kind of multiple step conversion that needs to happen. And, you know, a lot of the atheists, and this is a guy, right? Dulemon is a guy who actually did have training in hermeneutics, right? And pastoral work and all of this. And he's actually well-versed in theology. But, you know, 99% of atheists, professional atheists, were not Dulemon. They were not former seminarians with, you know, with theological degrees. They were just guys, and they would just encounter situations like this and just throw up their hands. You know, so what are you going to say?
That's one of the best stories, and in like you talking about this idea that, okay, I have an icon, but I'm an atheist, so it doesn't really matter. And you talk about this in your book, and you have different people mentioning it. Trotsky mentions it, like this idea of but. So like, what is but, and what does it mean, and how does its worth vary and change, you know, from Lenin and Stalin to Khrushchev and Brezhnev?
Well, I think the kind of the most forward or kind of straightforward definition is, you know, the way it's usually translated is everyday life, right? So wit is everyday life. I think everyday life doesn't quite actually capture some important aspects of it that were important for this project in particular. And that's the kind of sense of this everyday life being customary, right? Or kind of grounded in tradition and custom. And so really, you're talking about a kind of way of life, right? The Buddha is the way of life of a group of people, and it permeates the way that they organize their time, their space, how they understand their relationship to one another, to themselves, to the transcendent, right? It's a kind of system of let's say, anarchic system of beliefs and practices and relationships. And as Trotsky, you know, Trotsky was very focused on this because he said, you know, this is the most conservative sphere of human life, right? This is where people are the least likely to change, right? Why do I need to stop baptizing my child or crossing myself when I, you know, walk, you know, past an icon? Or why do I need to do things that I have done, that my parents have done? And there's this perception that they've always been done this way. And why would I be the one that somehow breaks with that way of doing things when that's just the way things are done, right? It's a sphere that's kind of taken for granted. Now, Trotsky and the kind of the Bolsheviks from the early Soviet period who really thought about this question, who were in the sphere of kind of cultural enlightenment, they would, you know, they would propagate so-called new wit, right? So this effort to change the ways that people live their lives and introduce new practices and get rid of backward old practices. And that included all sorts of things, not just, you know, baptizing, you know, not baptizing, but having a red christening or, you know, red birth rituals, but also, you know, things like hygiene or, you know, reading as a kind of way to pass your leisure time, right? All of this, which was by no means customary in Russia, right? Before the revolution, for the majority of the people, the idea that you would sit around and read, right, in the so-called reading hut, or spend your time going to lectures about, you know, astronomy as a kind of leisure activity. That's just that you know, you know, these things were not useful in the traditional kind of sense, right? So this is a kind of attempt to introduce them into life, to people that had not, you know, embraced these practices in the past. So so this was a sphere that was traditionally understood to be conservative, to be least most resistant to change. It was considered to be backward in Russia because they considered Russia to be backward. So therefore, its customary ways were inherently backward and needed to be modernized and changed. And it was also the sphere to which people, they perceived, on the one hand, people to be the most attached, you know, the least willing to give up those practices. And therefore, on the other hand, the sphere in which Soviet power had the least presence, the kind of least, that it really was aware that it didn't penetrate that, that part of Soviet life. That when people went home and shut the door, a lot of them, you know, they did, it's not that they didn't embrace Soviet practices, you know, that was part of it, but they continued to also, you know, live their lives as their parents had lived their lives. And this was the practices that the Soviet ideological apparatus really wanted to break. So this was the kind of the final frontier, if you will, of the atheist campaign, was to create a kind of atheist wit.
That's interesting, because when you were talking earlier about the different changes in Soviet historiography and like a focus on totalitarianism, and I think when you're looking at religion and how they're trying to inculcate these, you know, atheistic practices, we kind of touch on the idea of the totalitarian sphere, but it's very similar to religion and religious practices. I mean, you see it in modern churches now saying, you know, you're Christian on Sunday, but what are you on Monday? So you see it the same way. You're a Soviet atheist, you know, at work. So what are you at home? So it's interesting that these questions of atheism and religion are very similar. But in the Soviet space, we tend to frame it as, you know, a totalitarian way of being rather than seeing it as a change of belief system, similar to what we see in modern Christianity.
Yeah, well, this is where it gets interesting and political, I think, right? Because in a way, why, you know, when people use terms like political religion or totalitarianism, the inherent connotation is that this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
That this, you know, what is a political religion? It's politics that acts like a religion, which is, we all understand to be wrong, somehow, you know, transgressive of the sphere where politics is allowed to act on human life, right? So there's this sense, right? You know, why when nobody says the word political religion in a positive way. So, you know, there are things, the assumption there, the kind of unarticulated assumption is that there are things that are inherent to and perfectly acceptable for religion. For example, you know, who are you on Monday if you were in church, you know, as opposed to Sunday when you're not, you know, when you're in church. Whereas these same kind of structures and practices are considered to be some kind of violation when they are political. And, you know, you could say, okay, well, in some ways it's because religion is grounded in an authority that is outside the human. And so you don't question, you know, the kind of demands that are placed on you because they're considered to be outside of human behavior, of human society. Whereas politics is very much grounded in the human. So you do question the demands that a political regime is placing on you because you're then having one set of people or one person, in effect, with a great deal of authority over another group of people, and this is somehow perceived to be wrong, right? Now, I'm kind of trying to flesh out the things that we don't usually talk about when we throw around these terms. But, you know, of course, religions, and I would say certain religions more than others, their ambitions are totalitarian. They want you to live by the precepts of the faith, right? They don't want you to leave those behind and behave differently in different contexts. They want you to you know, to live in a world that is imbibed with those values everywhere. So yeah, of course, it's total. So you could say it's totalitarian. You know, I think some are more than others. What's interesting is that a lot of religions are like that in theory, but they're not like that in practice. So for example, you know, the Catholic Church, for example, is one that tolerates a great deal of, gives the layperson a good deal of leeway in their behavior, right? In the kind of, in the world. And in a way, the Orthodox Church as well, right? They don't excommunicate people for not living up to every precept of the faith. Mm-hmm. Because in Orthodoxy, you know, and in Catholicism, above all, what's important is not, it's not just what you believe, it's that you recognize the authority of the church, right? So as long as you recognize the authority of the church and you don't question that authority and you, you know, behave in accordance with its precepts, you know, whether or not you actually believe or don't believe is a kind of is a secondary kind of question to some degree, which is interesting in the Soviet context because, you know, the Russian, you know, they're so focused on Russian Orthodoxy and, you know, I mean, this is again, a very, in a way, like a stereotype, but, you know, the liturgy is so important in Orthodoxy. And so I think it's not accidental that they land on socialist rituals as really being the primary tool or weapon that they should focus on in trying to marginalize Orthodoxy and overcome and replace Orthodoxy. Because, you know, what they're seeing is even when people, you know, say they don't believe in God and really don't do almost anything else, you know, and religion doesn't appear in their lives in any way, they will still baptize their child and they will still have a religious funeral. And so this is Orthodox people. And so they realize that, you know, this is where the majority of Soviet people still have ties to religion and the church. Right? It's not about what they believe. And so then the question becomes, why did the party not just do what the church does to some degree and kind of just live with the contradiction, right? Like the church, so thinking about it a little bit differently, you know, the Catholic Church, because all of its members, you know, purported members are not all living a perfect Catholic life. It doesn't say, well, we failed, we should close up shop. Right. Uh-huh. Like, which is in effect kind of how the atheists and the communists are reading it. They're like, oh my God, nobody's doing the right thing. We should, you know, does this mean we're wrong? Right. This is, and I think that's the part that's really interesting, right? Like the Catholic Church doesn't say, oh my God, are we wrong? Nobody's listening to us. You know, people are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And does this mean that, you know, we're gonna fail? It's like a very different, you know, the kind of, and this, I think this is really where I think Yuri Sloskin's work is very helpful because that kind of, pressure on the member is really, I mean, almost, you know, it's, you know, you can have those kinds of demands on a small sect, right? Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to expand, you know, that and demand that level of adherence and devotion and conviction of 140 million people, right? That's, in a way, that was their criteria for success. You know, they would succeed when all Soviet people became disciplined, convinced communists and atheists and would do nothing that would contradict their conviction, which meant that they could not baptize their kid because that would, you know, was at odds with their atheist conviction. And if it's at odds with their atheist conviction, then they wouldn't do it, right? And so if that's your standard for success, you know, that's okay if you're a sect and you can live outside the world, but that's a very different kind of project as a political project, right? To kind of measure your progress in those terms. So I think, you know, Yuri Soskin's book, it really does a really incredible job of showing that this kind of demands, the uncompromising, you know, unwillingness to what they, you know, called appeasing, right? Or hypocrisy, or indifference. All of these things were intolerable. You couldn't be indifferent to Soviet ideology and have the party be okay with that.
Right.
Now I'm talking in theory, right? In practice, of course, by the end, everybody was indifferent to Soviet ideology and the party knew it. And this is, you know, this is kind of where the book ends. But in theory, right, that's why this for them is perceived as such a crisis, because they see that everybody's indifferent. They're aware of it. They try to address it. And, you know, by that point, it's pretty clear that if they want to hold on to political power, they can't continue to try to convert people to a system of values and ideology that has been discredited.
Right. There's this really great quote, and it kind of shows this interesting syncretism between Soviet ideology and religion, where a worker says, "We believe in God, Lenin, and Khrushchev." And he doesn't see anything wrong with that. And so you're like, if the party would just kind of accept that, like, okay, we've reached the level of God in terms of they understand us and they appreciate us. But like this constant drive to clear out all religion, it kind of speaks to the inability of the state to kind of grapple with this holdover from Russian culture. If you understand, like, people are Orthodox, they may not be great Orthodox, but, you know, Orthodox followers, but they do some of these rituals and kind of take that and change that. And they kind of do. You talk about the rituals, and there's some amazing rituals you talk about in the book. Like, can we talk about the wedding palaces and the cosmonaut wedding? Because those are some of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah. Well, so if you think about, you know, Christianity, right? It goes from being this very demanding millenarian sect to spreading and adapting to different places and cultures, and incorporating the, so, you know, kind of traditional, or let's say, you know, quote unquote pagan practices into the broader repertoire, right, of Christian liturgy. So, you know, that is something that, you know, that in a way allows a new religion to feel authentic to a group of people, right? Because it continues to speak to things that they already find to be meaningful, and they continue practices, but it has, you know, and with time that kind of overlay becomes invisible and it just seems like it's always been that way. So the Soviets, you know, also were aware of this, and the rituals, they do eventually, you know, the book is organized chronologically, right? And I think it's telling that they come to the, you know, the ritual chapter is chapter 6 of 7, right? So they eventually get to this issue of rituals, and they are aware in creating rituals that really they have to incorporate local tradition. So what their ideal scenario is one in which they take what they see as folk rituals, they clean out, you know, all of the religious nonsense, and they insert, you know, Soviet patriotism and Lenin. And then you have a good Soviet ritual, right? You're doing some kind of, you know, a practice that incorporates, you know, folk costumes, right, which are different. If you're in Belarus, it looks one way. If you're in Ukraine, it looks another way. If you're in Georgia, it looks a third way, right? So there's this acknowledgement, right, that people come to these practices with a history, that they're not, you know, born yesterday and are ready to embrace a kind of completely new system. So they do this. And then, you mentioned the cosmonaut wedding. you know, this was the kind of, let's say, like, maybe like the opening salvo, right, of this project, because it was entirely new. And, you know, in 1958, basically what you have is the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League, coming together and raising this issue of, you know, why can't, I mean, to make it very basic, you know, why can't we as Soviet young people have a nice wedding? So, which is, you know, an interesting thing to talk about in the late 50s, because then it makes you realize that up until the late 50s, Soviet young people didn't, you know, if they were in the Komsomol, right, in the Communist Youth League, you know, what a wedding looked like was you went to the local, you know, the kind of equivalent of City Hall, the local registry bureau, you signed some papers, and then, you know, went home and had a party, maybe, right, or maybe not. And so at some point in the late 50s, as part of this atheist campaign, they say, well, why can't we create atheist rituals? You know, we didn't have weddings because they're religious, but why can't we have, you know, Soviet socialist ones? And then, of course, by this is around the same time that the ideological apparatus is also recognizing that it's those rituals, those same rituals, which are the most tenacious element of religion. And so they say, yeah, right, okay, so let's create some rituals. And what we need is also elevated ritual spaces. You can't have a nice, beautiful Soviet wedding in a bureaucratic office, which is would be the only space available in 1957, right? So they open up, they create what they call wedding palaces, and they start opening these wedding palaces. They open the first ones in Leningrad, then in Moscow, and then actually all over the whole Soviet Union. They also open not as broadly, but baby palaces. So, you know, places where you could register the birth of a child. And this was another kind of socialist ritual that was promoted. And so, you know, they open up these wedding palaces, and actually people take to them, you know, quite a bit, you know, because why not? You know, before you had to go to an office and sign some papers, now you get to wear a beautiful dress, have a party, you know, drink some champagne. And all of this is happening in a beautiful space, as opposed to in a shabby office with some, you know, disgruntled lady kind of shoving papers at you, right? So this is, you know, this actually worked. This was quite popular. The kind of biggest, let's say, propaganda moment in the early opening kind of salvo of this campaign was that the first female cosmonaut in the world, Valentina Tereshkova, was getting married to a male cosmonaut, Adrian Nikolaev. This was a huge event. And Khrushchev, you know, said, well, you know, they're going to have a Soviet wedding in Moscow Palace, wedding palace number one, and Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, was their witness, and Valentina Tereshkova was there wearing a white wedding dress, and, you know, this is like the sign, the symbol of female liberation, and yeah, they had this cosmonaut wedding, and then, you know, of course, because it's cosmonauts, and this is in 1963, because it's cosmonauts, everybody, you know, is reading this, is watching this. This is like a huge celebrity event. You know, it's like watching, I don't know, a royal wedding, right? Everybody's like, what is Meghan wearing? And, you know, so they're looking at the same thing and following, you know, where did they go? What did they do? You know, how does it look? And this, you know, the coverage of it is meticulous, and just saying, oh, first they, you know, they say these, and then the lady in the palace says this, you know, so in a way, it's a kind of way to teach Soviet people, including Soviet local officials, how to conduct a proper Soviet wedding. But it's being done not, you know, under the guise of just relaying, right, how these two celebrities tie the knot. Actually, one photograph that's not in the book, because it doesn't quite, you know, it's not central to the argument, but it's a photograph I found in the archive, and I think it just speaks to the kind of celebrity stature of the cosmonauts. It's actually a photo taken outside of the maternity ward when Valentina Tereshkova had her child, because they had a child, the female and male cosmonaut, right? So they had a cosmonaut baby. And it's a photograph taken on the day that she's supposed to be leaving this maternity ward with her baby. And it is just a sea of people waiting for her to come out with this baby. And you're just looking at it like, it's just hard to comprehend. You know, there are people sitting on each other's shoulders. There are people hanging off trees. There are people, you know, on light poles. I mean, it's just a complete celebrity circus for this woman and her baby. And you can think of, you know, what a woman, you know, it's like what happens with, you know, with Kate Middleton, right? Mm-hmm. Like when she comes out with her baby, right? So I point this out because this image just communicates the kind of celebrity power of these people. So of course you're going to, you know, deploy them if you're trying to promote new practices as, you know, new norms. That you hope people will do, because every Soviet person wanted to be a cosmonaut. So yeah, they didn't get married like that too.
Well, Victoria, we've taken up a lot of your time today. But before we sign off, I wanted to ask you the famous last question of New Books Network. What are you working on now?
Well, I am working, one of the things I didn't get to do in this book was deal with, so this book is about the internal development of atheism as part of communist ideology, and it really deals with Soviet communism as a kind of closed system, and that means that it really privileges the Russian Orthodox Church and Russian Orthodoxy as the kind of norm, right, with which the Soviet regime or Soviet ideology is in conversation. What I had to not address as much as I wanted to was non-Orthodox groups in the book, which I had done the research, but it just, you know, became unwieldy as a narrative, and also foreign policy. And the international situation. So I'm working in a book that in some ways is a kind of mirror image of this book, if you can kind of see what I mean, in that it deals with non-Orthodox groups. I'm dealing primarily with the Catholic Church, but also with groups with religious confessions concentrated on the Western borderlands. So in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, West Ukraine, and looking at the role that religion played on the one hand in Soviet foreign policy, and on the other in international, in global politics as a kind of mobilizing force for anti-communism. So it's a kind of global history that looks at the religious factor as it kind of mobilized different groups outside the Soviet Union, and then how the Soviet Union would respond to, you know, for example, the efforts of human rights activists to draw attention to religious repression, or, religious tourists bringing in religious objects, or Radio Vatican, you know, blasting, across Soviet borders, broadcasting across Soviet borders. I think one of the, I think anti-communism is a tremendously powerful phenomenon that hasn't yet been adequately understood and kind of discussed outside of the American context, and certainly not in conversation with what's actually going on in the Soviet Union. And so that's my hope, is to kind of put those two histories that have usually been distinct and kind of not in conversation with one another into a bigger conversation that's transnational, and that allows you to actually see how different groups are relating to each other and responding to each other.
That sounds like a perfect follow-up to A Sacred Space Is Never Empty. Well, Victoria, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. I think the listeners are going to enjoy it. And take care.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. Thank you for having me.